Welcome to George Square Lecture Theatre. The Islamic and the Edinburgh Palestine Solidarity Societies of Edinburgh University would like to welcome you to come listen to a distinguished professor from the USA speak about the issue of Palestine. We have with us today Dr. Norman Finkelstein, and of course, with Gaza in the news these past few days, it's a very topical issue, and we're very happy to have a very high-profile and knowledgeable person to come discuss these issues with us today. So, the talk will go on for about an hour and a half to an hour 45 minutes. After that, you'll have a chance to ask some questions. We ask you to bear with us. Sorry for the delay. And I'll just remind you to turn off your phones. And let me present Norman Finkelstein, speaking about Palestine's occupation, roots of the problem, prospects for peace. Thank you very much.
Can you hear me in the back? I think so, it's working. Good. Well, thank you very much for coming out to hear me. And this has been the end of a rather long speaking tour of the UK. The FOSIS organization, the Federation of Student Islamic Societies, is remarkably efficient. I think it's too efficient. I haven't had a chance to breathe yet. And it's a great compliment to them. It's a gratifying thing to see that the Islamic and Arab students are getting their act together, and hopefully they'll give the powers that be a run for their money henceforth, and that they will learn how to fight back in appropriate ways and get the respect and dignity that all people deserve in our society and elsewhere in the world. Just like I think that a couple of days ago, the Palestinian people, for the second time, the first time was in 1987, the first intifada, and now for the second time have learned, and now I'm speaking as an atheist, that God helps those who help themselves. Don't look to silly, farcical conferences and vacuous, empty peace processes. The only way you're going to genuinely improve your lives is by seizing the initiative and doing what needs to be done. In the case of Gaza, it was detonating the hideous walls of their prison. And the case of FOSIS, it's learning the art of being efficient, competent, running a sound operation, even if it does squander the residues and remnants of energy of a middle-aged Jew from Brooklyn. Having said that, the topic I want to speak about this evening is one I find more and more perplexing and more illuminating as time elapses. Namely, if you look at the actual documentary record on the Israel-Palestine conflict, the past, the historical record, the present, which basically means the human rights record, and the future, which basically means the diplomatic record, how do you resolve the conflict. The Israel-Palestine conflict is a remarkably uncontroversial and uncomplicated conflict. It does not raise any longer any significant historical, moral, or legal questions. At all levels, there's a remarkable consensus on what happened, what's happening, and what needs to be done to achieve, under the circumstances, a just and lasting resolution. And yet, some of you are no doubt wondering, how can I make a claim of that sort in the face of the fact that if you look at what the media have to say when you enter into public life and public debate, it appears as if the conflict is remarkably complicated, complex. It defies conventional forms of analysis, and it raises these cosmic questions that make it, we are told, not easily amenable to a resolution. And the argument I'm going to make this evening is that most of the controversy that swirls around the Israel-Palestine conflict, the preponderance of the controversy, is contrived. It's fabricated. It's artificial. And the purpose of this contrived controversy is to deflect attention away from the documentary record to which I'll refer presently, and to sow confusion about what the real issues are in the Israel-Palestine conflict. Well, that's a big challenge on my part. But before I start reviewing systematically the record to try to convince you of my point of view, I'll start with just a simple illustration of the claim I'm making. In July 2004, the highest judicial body in the world, the International Court of Justice, rendered a landmark advisory opinion on the legality of the wall that Israel has been building in the West Bank. The General Assembly of the United Nations made a formal request of the World Court to render an opinion. Is the wall that Israel has been constructing in the West Bank, is it legal under international law? Some of you in this room will know, no doubt, that the International Court of Justice decided in its advisory opinion the wall was illegal, Israel had to dismantle it, and had to pay compensation for the damages wrought by the construction thus far of the wall. But in fact, that was the least significant aspect, in my opinion at any rate, of the International Court's decision. Because in order for the International Court to render its opinion on the legality of the wall, it first had to answer a preliminary set of legal questions. And by coincidence, those questions the International Court had to answer were almost exactly the questions which were normally told are what are called the final status questions of the peace process. For those of you who are not familiar with this arcane jargon, there is this phenomenon, it's called the peace process. And then we're told there are some aspects of the Israel-Palestine conflict which are so controversial, so complex, so intricate, that they have to be deferred to the last stage of negotiations because they're so hard to solve. Now, as it happens, the World Court, in order to render its opinion on the legality of the wall, had to contend with precisely those questions. So for those of you who are relatively knowledgeable on the topic, you'll know that the main final status questions are generally said to be four. Number one, what are the legal borders of the State of Israel? And what ought to be the legal borders of the future state of Palestine? Number two, what is the legal status of the settlements that Israel has been building in the occupied territories? And what's the legal status of the 400,000 settlers, the Jewish settlers, who currently reside in the occupied territories? And number three, what's the legal status of East Jerusalem? There's a fourth question, which is typically called a final status question, namely the refugee question, to which I'll return further on. But let's look at those first three questions. I think nobody here would dispute that they are always called the three most complicated questions of the so-called peace process, the fourth being the refugees. Well, the court did render a decision on those questions. Number one, the question of borders. The International Court of Justice said, there's a fundamental principle of international law. It's anchored in the United Nations Charter. And the principle is, it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. That's a basic principle of international law. The fancy term that legal scholars use is that it's a peremptory norm. That means a bedrock principle of international law. Well, Israel acquired the West Bank and Gaza in the course of the June 1967 war. Therefore, under international law, it has no legal title, says the World Court, to the West Bank and Gaza. And throughout its opinion, the World Court refers to the West Bank and Gaza as, quote, occupied Palestinian territories, capital O, capital P, capital T. In human rights reports, you'll often see the shorthand OPT. Well, that means, according to the World Court, the highest judicial body in the world, the West Bank and Gaza are not, as we're often told in public life, they are not disputed territories. Under international law, there is no dispute whatsoever. There is no margin of equivocation or ambiguity. These are, in total and in sum, and unequivocally and unambiguously, occupied Palestinian territories. Number two, the question of those 400,000 settlers and the settlements in the occupied territories. What is their legal status under international law? Once again, the World Court rendered a definitive opinion. It stated, under international law, in particular, Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, it's illegal for an occupying power to transfer its population to occupied territory. Bedrock principle of international law. Accordingly, says the World Court, all the settlements and all the settlers constitute, and then the World Court quotes the UN Security Council resolution, they constitute a flagrant violation of international law. Full stop, case closed. Number three, we're often told that this Jerusalem question is a very tough nut to crack. And it's a very complicated, intricate question. Israel, for its part, claims that East Jerusalem is part of its eternal and undivided capital. But not so, says the World Court. Israel acquired East Jerusalem in the course of the June 1967 war. Returning to that bedrock principle of international law, the inadmissibility of acquiring territory by war, Israel has no title whatsoever to East Jerusalem. So throughout the World Court decision, they refer to the West Bank, comma, including East Jerusalem, comma, and Gaza as occupied Palestinian territories. So we see that these questions, which we're told are so complicated, have already found an authoritative resolution in the World Court. But that's only half the story. The other half of the story is International Court of Justice opinions are often quite close. You take, for example, the 1996 International Court of Justice opinion on the legality of nuclear weapons. The question arose, since nuclear weapons are unable to discriminate between civilians and combatants, and a fundamental rule of international humanitarian law is you have to make that distinction in combat, are nuclear weapons legal? And that particular case, the vote was 8-7. It was close. It was a tie-breaking vote by the president. And I can go through, if time were to allow me, give many examples like that. But this isn't what happened when it came to these particular questions to which I just addressed myself a moment ago. The vote was 14-1. It wasn't close at all. The one dissenting vote, to which I'll turn a moment, came from the judge, the American judge, Thomas Bergenthal. The British judge on the court is a distinguished jurist named Rosalind Higgins. She's Jewish by birth. She's married to an Irishman. She voted with a majority in the court at 14-1 vote. There was no controversy whatsoever on these allegedly controversial questions because these are bedrock principles of international law which have long ago been resolved among jurists and legal scholars. In fact, if you look at other international court decisions, if you look at what's called the majority opinions, the separate opinions, the declarations, and the dissents, they're often quite hefty documents. They'll run the order of 1,000 pages or so, often, incidentally, quite interesting to read. But when you come to this particular case, if you take the majority opinion, separate opinions, and Judge Bergenthal's declaration, it comes to less than 100 pages because there was nothing to debate. There was nothing to discuss. These are not controversial questions under international law. They are so uncontroversial that even if you take the one negative vote, namely by Judge Bergenthal, Bergenthal called his statement, he did not call it the dissent. He used a more neutral term, which is permissible in the world court lexicon. He called his statement a declaration. And he began his declaration by saying, "There is much in the majority opinion with which I agree." And then he concludes his declaration with a quite remarkable statement. It's no secret to anyone in this room, because you hear it all the time, that the main obstacle to resolving this conflict is those settlements, the 400,000 Jewish settlers who currently reside in the occupied Palestinian territories and who are consuming large amounts of land, resources, and so forth. Well, even Judge Bergenthal stated, he says, it's correct. Under Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, all those settlements are illegal. And he goes on to say, if Israel is building the wall to incorporate or protect those settlements, then the wall is, quote, ipso facto illegal as well. And so now we have the remarkable finding that on the fundamental question bearing on this conflict, the vote is actually 15-0. It's an extraordinary consensus, and the extraordinary consensus is not born of the fact, as some people like to say, that the whole world is anti-Semitic, and therefore this court must be anti-Semitic as well, because that would make Thomas Bergenthal and Rosalind Higgins anti-Semites, an odd sort of conclusion for those of you familiar with their histories, because there is no controversy bearing on these issues. That's why the consensus was so broad. In this case, it was a perfect consensus. Well, let me now use the next few minutes to try to run through the three aspects of the conflict, which I think can illustrate in a hopefully convincing way the argument I'm trying to make this evening. Let's start with the historical aspect of the conflict. For those people in this room, and it's clearly a small, tiny minority, who are roughly in my age cohort or beyond, they will remember that about 20 years ago, the most contentious issue in the history of the conflict, the one people argued about most and were most passionate about, was clearly how did those Palestinians become refugees in 1948. For those of you who are new to the subject, in November 1947, the United Nations General Assembly decides to partition Palestine between a Jewish and an Arab state, and beginning in December 1947, hostilities break out in Palestine, and then in May 1948, the hostilities become interstate hostilities, a regional war, and by January 1949, when the war is over, there are approximately 750,000 Palestinians who found themselves outside their homes and outside the newly created state of Israel. And those 750,000 Palestinians, plus their several generations now of descendants, are what are typically referred to as the Palestinian refugee question. And there was always a heated debate, as I said earlier, about how these Palestinians became refugees. The official position of Israel, which was echoed by the mainstream scholarship and mainstream media, was that the Arab armies stood poised on the borders of the newly born state of Israel. They transmitted these radio messages telling the Palestinian Arabs to flee, and that the invading Arab armies would sweep the Jews into the sea, and then the Palestinian Arabs could return to their homes. And that came to be called the Arab radio broadcast's explanation for the refugee question. Well, beginning in the mid-1980s, a new generation of Israeli scholars began to examine the archival record of Israel, and the most notable of them is a fellow named Benny Morris. And Morris looks at the record and he says, well, there's no real evidence for this Arab radio broadcast's allegation. And he then, in recent years, has forthrightly said, and now I'm using his expression, not my own, he said that what happened in 1948 was an ethnic cleansing. And there's now a broad consensus, you can say, among Israeli scholars that, in fact, what happened in 1948 was, to use the current phraseology, an ethnic cleansing. It is true that there is some range of disagreement within this broad consensus. Some scholars, like Benny Morris, claim that the Palestinians were cleansed of Palestine unintentionally in the course of a war. We all know that wars generate refugees, and he claims that this refugee problem was an accident of war. But then there are other scholars who say not so. It was premeditated, it was intentional, it was rooted in the goal of trying to create a Jewish state in an area which was overwhelmingly not Jewish. to illustrate to you just how little debate there really is any longer in the real world about what used to be the most contentious issue on the Israel-Palestine conflict, you can take the case of Israel's former foreign minister, Shlomo Ben Ami. Shlomo Ben Ami is a very smart fellow, and he recently wrote a book for Oxford University Press called Scars of War, Wounds of Peace. And he addresses the refugee question. And he says, well, I agree with Benny Morris that they were ethnically cleansed in 1948. But says Shlomo Ben Ami, I don't agree with Mr. Morris that it was an accident of war. He says, speaking now as the former foreign minister of Israel, he says, I think it was premeditated. I think it was intentional. I think, to quote him, it was anchored in the Zionist philosophy of transfer. And so now you have the remarkable case of Israel's former foreign minister taking the most extreme interpretation of what happened in 1948 to the Palestinians and how they became refugees. And in fact, if you look at the full sweep of scholarship on all these topics about which so many fantastical claims are made in the mainstream media, scholars have long discarded these claims. One last illustration, because of the limitations of time. Take the question of Israel's history of wars with its Arab neighbors. A very distinguished scholar, his name is Ze'ev Ma'oz. He was the former director of the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University, a prestigious institution, and he is for sure a first-rate scholar. And he recently came out with this very hefty volume called Defending the Holy Land. And the book is basically a history of all of Israel's wars with its Arab neighbors. And it's not original research, and he doesn't claim it to be. It's based mostly on what scholars have written. It's an exhaustive summary of the scholarly consensus. I don't have time, obviously, to go through the details of what he demonstrates in those 800 pages, but allow me just to briefly read his conclusions and decide for yourself the extent to which the mainstream media accurately represents what scholars have been saying for years. So Ze'ev Ma'oz writes, Israel's war experience is a story of folly, recklessness, and self-made traps. None of Israel's wars, none, with a possible exception of the 1948 War of Independence, none of the wars was a war of necessity. They were all wars of choice or folly. Israel's decision makers were as reluctant and risk averse when it came to making peace as they were daring and trigger happy when it came to making war. The official Israeli decision makers typically did not initiate peace overtures. Most of the peace initiatives in the Arab-Israeli conflict came either from the Arab world, from the international community, or from grassroots and informal channels. When Israel was willing to take risks for peace, these usually paid off. The Arabs generally showed a remarkable tendency for compliance with their treaty obligations. In quite a few cases, it was Israel, rather than the Arabs, that violated formal and informal agreements. That's the accurate rendering of what scholarship shows, but obviously radically at odds with what we're conventionally told in public life about the history of Israel's wars with its Arab neighbors. Let me turn now to the present basically meaning the human rights record in the occupied territories. We're often told that the human rights question, the occupied territories, is very complicated. In the case of the American media, which I'm best familiar with, or most familiar with, what typically happens when there is a death, a killing, a clash, the American reporter will go to the scene and first say, the Palestinians say this, then they tell you the Israeli government says that. Usually those are two diametrically different interpretations of what happened. And then the reporter effectively throws his or her hands in the air in despair. Who knows who's telling the truth? The odd thing is, there's nowhere else in the world, literally nowhere else in the world, where that standard is used. In any other country in the world, if you look how the coverage unfolds, it's always the same. The reporter goes in the country, and if there is a human rights question, the reporter doesn't consult the victim, doesn't consult the state. They go to the local reputable human rights organization and asks them, what's the situation here? So they'll ask the local representative of Human Rights Watch or the local representative of Amnesty International, what happened? Or they'll ask a reputable, independent human rights organization based in the country. But remarkably, that never happens when it comes to the Israel-Palestine conflict. And in fact, if you look at the record of the human rights organizations, there is no controversy whatsoever on the real human rights situation in the occupied territories. And that in itself is a remarkable fact. Number one, human rights law is a relatively new body of international law. That means there are still a lot of gray areas in the definition of terms, and then additionally gray areas in the application of these rules of human rights. Number two, Israel-Palestine is probably the most heavily monitored area in the world by human rights organizations. There are the big human rights organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, and then there are the local organizations, most notably B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, but then there is PCATI, the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel, Physicians for Human Rights, Gisha, HaMoked. There's a large number. And for better or for worse, they churn out weekly large numbers of reports on what's going on there, almost impossible for a mortal person to keep up with. And you would expect between the vagueness of a lot of human rights law and the huge number of people monitoring it, you would expect there'd be a lot of disagreement about what they found. And in addition, a lot of human rights work is very vulnerable to human error. So it consists of, if there's a demonstration in a town in the West Bank, in Hebron, the human rights field worker goes out and has to observe who initiated the clash. And if it's the Palestinians who initiated the clash, did they use stones or did they use live ammunition? And if it's the Israelis who initiated the clash, were they in a life-threatening position? Did they fire warning shots? Where did they aim? Did they aim to kill or did they aim to injure? And you can imagine a lot of this requires very subtle judgments and different people looking at the same incident. For those of you who know the famous Kurosawa film, Rashomon, different people looking at the same incident often remember it very differently. So on the basis of all of these factors, you might assume that there's a large amount of disagreement about Israel's human rights record in the occupied territories. But in fact, there is no disagreement at all. What was most remarkable for me a couple of years ago, I sat down and I read several thousands of pages of human rights reports on the Israel-Palestine conflict for a book that I was writing. And I could tell you without fear of contradiction, and if a polygraph were put to my wrist, I'm confident my heart wouldn't skip a beat, that in those thousands of pages of human rights reports covering a two-decade period, a 20-year period, I only was able to detect one case of one incident on one day in one town of during a demonstration where two human rights organizations disagreed about what happened. And in fact, the disagreement was completely trivial. There is no disagreement, there is no controversy about Israel's human rights record. Okay, well, what does it look like? So let's try to look at one concrete example. When the Hamas, when the Islamic movement was elected to power in the occupied Palestinian territories in January 2006, Israel immediately imposed brutal economic sanctions on the Palestinian people, quickly followed by the United States, and soon thereafter by the cowardly and craven European Union. And the first justification, rationale, for imposing these standards was that the Hamas movement was guilty of practicing terrorism, and under international law, it was duty-bound to renounce terrorism to enter the community of civilized nations, as it's called. Well, it seems to me not a controversial question. It's pretty much a no-brainer, I think, that terrorism is illegal under international law, and Hamas is duty-bound to renounce the resort to terrorism, terrorism being the targeting of civilians to achieve a political end. That's the standard definition of terrorism. And so I don't think we should be detained on that particular question. It's clear that Hamas has an obligation to renounce terrorism. At any rate, it's clear to the international community. That's not the problem. The problem is, if you apply a principle across the board to all parties, it's a moral and a legal principle. If you apply that principle to only one side, it ceases to be a moral and legal principle, and it's a hypocritical principle. Everybody in this room understands that. So what we now have to do is take this principle of the renunciation of terrorism and apply it across the board. And let's see what we get. And henceforth, I want to emphasize, as I'll try to do throughout my remarks this evening, I'm not rendering any particularly individual opinions. I'm simply trying to look at what the mainstream human rights organizations have said. So during the period of what's called the Second Intifada, namely from September 2000 until today, the official numbers are 4,437 Palestinians have been killed, 1,030 Israelis have been killed, roughly a ratio of 4-1. If we look only at civilian deaths, the ratio is roughly 3-4 times as many Palestinians have been killed as Israeli civilians have been killed. Now that's a minimum ratio, because it doesn't include, for example, each time a Palestinian is killed at a checkpoint because he or she couldn't reach a hospital, or each time Israel cuts the fuel or electricity in the Gaza and Palestinian children perish in incubators, that's not counted in these numbers. These are just deaths in the course of clashes. The ratio is about 3-4 times as many Palestinians killed as Israelis killed. Now, some of you who have your critical faculties at work or have been assigned the unpleasant duty of attending my lecture to detect my biases and prejudices and my advocacy of terrorism and all the rest, you will no doubt be thinking at this moment, but Professor Finkelstein is obviously engaging in some sort of chicanery, because isn't there a difference between Palestinians targeting Israeli civilians and Israel unintentionally killing Palestinian civilians? That's the conventional argument made, and we should not ignore conventional arguments, nor should we just dismiss them with a smirk. We should try to look at them rationally, analytically, and see if there's any elements of truth to it. So there's this very prominent American reporter named Jeffrey Goldberg. He writes for a magazine called The New Yorker, and he recently came out with a book just translated in the UK called Prisoners, about his experience as a guard in the Gaza during the First Intifada. And at one point he recounts his conversation with a Palestinian, and he says to the Palestinian, a Hamas member, if my memory serves, he says, "For God's sake, we don't try to kill Palestinian children." That's supposed to be the difference. We don't try to. In our case, it's just an accident. So what does the record show? Well, let's start with the raw material, the numbers. For the period of the last 7 years, 867 Palestinian children have been killed during the Second Intifada. That is, more Palestinian children have been killed than the total number of Israeli civilians killed. The total number of Israeli civilians is 705, of whom 119 were children. So if you compare the number of children killed on both sides, the ratio is about 8-1. In the past year, 92 Palestinian children have been killed, 0 Israeli children have been killed. So based on the raw numbers, we can say that for the want of trying to kill Palestinian children, it would seem that Israelis were awfully good at it. But is it true? Is it true that Israel doesn't target Palestinian children? Not so, says Amnesty International. They write that unarmed Palestinian demonstrators, mostly children, were, quote, on many occasions deliberately targeted by Israel, while in other cases Israel used indiscriminate, excessive, and disproportionate force. So if you take the case of just the first month of the Second Intifada, September to October 2000, 37 Palestinian children were killed in that first month. Fully 20 of those 37 died from a direct bullet shot to the head, hardly an accident. But we still have to look not at the deliberate killings of children. What about those Palestinians who are killed in the course of indiscriminate fire, spraying bullets into a crowd, or indiscriminately firing artillery on a civilian neighborhood? In fact, under international law, the indiscriminate killing of people is exactly the same or treated in an identical fashion to targeted killings. Why? Because under international law, the foreseeable and inevitable consequences of an act count as an intention. Now that sounds kind of abstract and takes you a little time to assimilate and digest. The inevitable and foreseeable consequences of an act count as an intention. So what does that mean? There's a fellow over there sitting in the fourth or fifth row, not pleased with what I have to say, growing progressively more agitated and exasperated, and at some point he decides to take out his dagger, plunge it into my heart, and dispatch me prematurely to my maker. Presumably there's the rule of law in Edinburgh. He's brought before a judge and he pleads to the judge, "I didn't intend to kill Professor Finkelstein. I was just testing the sharpness of my blade." Well, of course, that's a ludicrous defense, with all due respect to that fellow, because the inevitable and foreseeable consequence of plunging a dagger into my heart is I'm going to die. So it counts as an intention that that's the consequence that you wanted, that I'm going to die. The inevitable and foreseeable consequence counts as an intention. Well, what does that mean in the concrete case of Israel and Palestine, as against my own prematurely mortality? We can take the case of a very smart and very decent Israeli reporter, a fellow named Gideon Levy. He's the main Israeli reporter for the occupied territories on Israel's newspaper Haaretz. And he writes as follows. He's discussing Israel's indiscriminate artillery fire against the town of Beit Hanun in the Gaza. This was November 2006. And he takes all of these fancy legal principles, which I've just tried to suggest to you, and puts it in very concrete language, which I think everyone in the room will understand. He says, "Someone who throws burning matches into a forest can't claim he didn't mean to set it on fire. And anyone who bombards residential neighborhoods with artillery can't claim he didn't mean to kill innocent inhabitants. Therefore," says Mr. Levy, "it takes considerable gall and cynicism to dare to claim that the Israeli Defense Forces did not intend to kill inhabitants of Beit Hanun." Notice his selection of word, intend. It's the inevitable and foreseeable consequence, like throwing matches into a forest, there's going to be a fire. The inevitable and foreseeable consequence of indiscriminately shooting artillery into a civilian neighborhood is going to be civilians killed. That's the intention. It counts as an intention. For those of you who still have any doubts about the authority of this claim, in fact, Israel's leading authority in international law, a very smart guy, Yoram Dinstein, the president of Tel Aviv University, regrettably, whenever he has to write on questions bearing on Israel, he turns into a hack. But he's a very smart guy, and when you look at the general principles he enunciates, he's quite good, exceptionally lucid, and his grasp of English is quite terrifying, I think. He says in his standard study of the topic, "There is no genuine difference between a premeditated attack against civilians," which is what Hamas is accused of, "and the reckless use of force," which is what Israel is accused of. And his phrase is, "They are equally forbidden." They are equally forbidden. And with that in mind, we should be clear, using conventional terminology. Remember, a moment ago, I cited for you the conventional definition of terrorism: the targeting of civilians to achieve a political end. I don't think anyone here would dispute the definition. Now, Israel has openly, repeatedly said that the purpose of its lethal sanctions in Gaza, the purpose is to get the Palestinian people to reject Hamas, to repudiate the Hamas leadership. Well, that's a political goal, and you're targeting civilians, and civilians are dying due to those sanctions which are being targeted against them. Under international law, that is terrorism. It's the targeting of civilians to achieve a political end. And I think that's an unambiguous case of the application of terrorism. Each time a Palestinian child dies in a hospital because it's deprived of fuel or electricity or water, and Israel says its purpose is to target the civilian population to get them to repudiate terrorism, that's no different, excuse me, to get them to repudiate Hamas, that's no different than if Hamas blows up a bus. That's terrorism in the strictest, most narrow definition under international law. Well, where does that leave us? The bottom line conclusions seem to be two. Number one, judging by the numbers, Israeli terrorism is about 3 to 4 times as lethal as Palestinian terrorism. And number two, no sanctions, no demand has ever been put on Israel to renounce terrorism, only on the Palestinians and on Hamas. Well, that's not a legal principle then, and it's not a moral principle. It's an exercise in the grossest and the most egregious hypocrisy. If both sides are practicing terrorism and you're demanding only one side renounce it, you're not trying to impose a moral principle, you're trying to impose a hypocritical principle. Let's now turn to the future, because I suspect many people in this room will be willing to go with me a good deal to where I've gone. Namely, yes, we know all that you're saying, Professor Finkelstein, we know that the situation is terrible there, and Israel can't really conceal any longer the realities of the brutality of the occupation. That's pretty clear to anyone whose eyes are open and ears are open. But that still leaves the question, how do you resolve it? And how can you make the claim that this conflict, which has endured for 40 years now, or one phase of it has endured for 40 years, how can you make the claim that it's simple, uncontroversial? That doesn't seem to be accurate. Well, here again, we're not in the realm of speculation. We don't have to speculate. And the last thing I would want is for you to take me at my word. There's no reason why you should. We should look at the record, the documentary record. Now, as it happens, every year, you'd be very surprised, most people in this room, in fact, I suspect almost everyone in this room, every year, the United Nations General Assembly votes on how to resolve the conflict. It's called the Peaceful Settlement of the Palestine Question. And I would urge you to just take down those words, peaceful settlement of the Palestine question, and Google it and check for yourself. Because on Google, you can find the resolution every year. And every year, the United Nations puts forth the same proposal, a two-state settlement based on the June 1967 borders, a full Israeli withdrawal, a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, with East Jerusalem as its capital, and a just resolution of the refugee question in accordance with UN Resolution 194, the famous compensation or return resolution. In fact, if you open up today to the Financial Times, which I was reading this morning on the train, go look at their editorial. It's the same proposal. The Financial Times was very fair, reasonable. It said, this is how you resolve the conflict. It's got to be full Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, and let the Palestinians create their state there, and let's end it. Seems reasonable. Well, in fact, nearly the entire world agrees on that. Every year, that vote is put, 1989, the vote was 100 51-3, the whole world on one side, and the other side, United States, Israel, and the island state of Dominica. That's it. I mean, you can laugh, and it is deserving of a laugh or smile, but then you have to compare what the record shows with what we're constantly told about how controversial and difficult it is to resolve. 1997, I'll run through it quickly. The vote, 155-2. 1998, the vote, 154-2. Skipping a little, give me one moment. Skipping a little, 2002, the vote, 160-4. 2003, the vote, 160-6. 2004, the vote, 161-7. And then 2007, just this past month, the vote, 161-7. Now, some of you whose critical faculties are at high levels of scrutiny will have noticed that the number of dissents jumped from 2 to a whopping 7. And in fact, that's true. We don't want to evade the facts. And the 7 are always the same every year, or some variation of those 7. The United States, Israel, Nauru, N-A-U-R-U, Palau, P-A-L-A-U, Tuvalu, T-U-V-A-L-U, the Federated States of Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands. That's it. Now, for those of you who are a little embarrassed, being college students or college educated, and never having heard of Nauru, Palau, Tuvalu, even though broadly speaking I once taught the subject, I didn't know what they were until I started getting emails about them. They are South Sea atolls, islands, without being politically correct and disparaging little countries, we can say that their combined populations could fit in the empty seats in this room. That's it. I myself was rather surprised just a couple of days ago to prepare for the talks during my current speaking tour for Phocis. I checked what was the vote this past month because I hadn't looked at it. And my anticipation was that the vote was probably going to change a little because of the schism between Fatah and Hamas, and a lot of countries are probably going to drop out of the consensus and say a plague on all your houses. And I was surprised. No, there's no change. There's no disagreement. And we should bear in mind that that's the official position of the UK. The UK has always voted with the majority on this particular issue, even during the dreadful years of that Mr. Blair. The UK was voting with the majority just as Rosalind Higgins voted with the majority on the World Court. It's a very long resolution. Time obviously doesn't allow me to go through it, but the key points, just to confirm what we've said already, it says affirming the principle of the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war, reaffirming the illegality of the Israeli settlements in the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967, comma, including East Jerusalem, so on and so forth. And then at the end, it lays out the principles for resolving the conflict. And the principles are straightforward. The withdrawal of Israel from the Palestinian territory occupied since 1967, including East Jerusalem, the realization of the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people, primarily the right to self-determination and the right to their independent state, and a just resolution of the refugee question in conformity with UN Resolution 194. That's been it for the past 20 years. Every year, the UN reaffirms these basic principles for resolving the conflict, and the problem has been the same for the past at least two decades or more. namely the opposition of the United States and Israel to the consensus, international consensus for resolving the conflict. To give you some sense of how far back it goes, a large number of people in this room are roughly in the age cohort of 20 years old. And if you can take, you know, look at your life, reverse the reel for the past 20 years, and then double it, your whole life hitherto, and then double it, that's how long the United States and Israel have blocked this resolution of the conflict, and in the process inflicted nearly unendurable torment on the Palestinian people. Is it my claim? One of the leading jurists of the past generation was a fellow named Quincy Wright, international lawyers. And in 1970, he writes as follows. In view of the acceptance of UN Resolution 242, which lays out these basic principles for resolving the conflict, by the adjacent Arab states except Syria, the major obstacle to progress seems to be the refusal of Israel to do so and to agree to withdraw from occupied territories. That was the problem 40 years ago, and it's the problem till today. When former President Carter wrote his book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, it evoked a hysterical reaction in the United States. People were incensed by the book, and the thing that no doubt incensed them the most was his conclusion. His conclusion was, precisely based in a documentary record, he said, peace will come to Palestine and the Middle East when Israel finally obeys international law and withdraws to its legal borders. That's been the problem. That's the problem now, and it's been the problem for the past 40 years. So now we turn again to that basic principle of international law, namely the principle of applying the law across the board. And if it's not applied across the board, it's pure hypocrisy. So let's take this case. The second reason Hamas, those brutal sanctions were imposed on the Palestinian people, was the claim that Hamas refuses to recognize Israel as a condition for entering the community of civilized nations. It has to recognize Israel. Well, in fact, it is a basic principle of international law. Israel is a member state of the United Nations, and as a member state, it should be free from all threats or use of force. And I don't have, or no reasonable person, I think, would have an objection to that. That's the law. Hamas's record has been somewhat ambiguous on this particular question. Sometimes they speak about Israel's destruction, and other times they talk about having a long-term what they call hudna or armistice with Israel, and after 20 or so years deciding how to proceed. Okay, so the worst you can say for Hamas is its record on the principle of mutual recognition is ambiguous. And I think that's a reasonable statement. And you could say maybe Hamas should be less ambiguous in its statements. But then we turn to the other side. No Israeli government has ever recognized the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination in the whole of the West Bank and the whole of Gaza with East Jerusalem as its capital. That's the law. There has never been any initiative by the Israeli government, any leading Israeli official, any Israeli political party, which is willing to settle the conflict on the basis of the consensus of the international community and international law. In fact, as Hamas and the Palestinian people are being brutalized by these sanctions, because they don't recognize the state of Israel, the Israeli government simultaneously is illegally building a wall that's annexing 10% of the West Bank, illegally annexing East Jerusalem, severing the West Bank into multiple fragments, ethnically cleansing the Jordan Valley, de facto annexing the Jordan Valley, and as Israel's main newspaper itself put it, between the eastward expansion of the Israeli settlements, this is Haaretz in its editorial from February 2006, between the eastward expansion of the Israeli settlements and the westward expansion of the Israeli settlements, the Palestinians are left with no territory on which to establish a state. But once again, no sanctions are put on Israel. No demand is put on Israel as a condition for entering the community of civilized countries that has to recognize the Palestinian right to self-determination in the whole of the West Bank and Gaza with East Jerusalem as its capital. And if it's not applied across the board, it's not a legal principle. It's not a moral principle. It's a hypocritical principle. And we should be clear about that. Well, that, to my understanding, is the record on the Israel-Palestine conflict. Obviously, within the confines of a lecture, I couldn't possibly go through the details, so I did what I think a responsible person does, namely take the toughest cases. Take the case of the most controversial issues in the peace process, so-called, the most controversial historical questions, the refugee question, and the most controversial human rights question, the question of terrorism, and look at what the record actually shows, not just what the record shows, but what the consensus shows. Everything I've been talking about now, when you look at the actual documentary record, there's just no disagreement. There is none. It is devoid of even a speck of controversy. And that obviously raises the question then, if everything I'm saying is true, or for argument's sake it's true, then how do you account for all the controversies swirling around the conflict? And my conclusion is, most of the controversy is fake. It's just contrived in order to divert people's attention from what that record actually shows, from what the documentary record tells us. Now, I do think it's fair to say that there is an element of the Israel-Palestine conflict where the controversy is not contrived, where in fact there are legitimate differences. And allow me to illustrate that, because we should be clear about there are elements which, where honest people, I think, can disagree. So let's return to the question of the Palestinian refugees. The first thing to note is that there is a distinction between facts and moral judgments. Everyone can agree on the facts, but reach an altogether different judgment on the moral significance of the facts. What does that mean concretely? Well, take the case of this fellow Benny Morris, an Israeli historian who's written so exhaustively, copiously, on the Palestinian refugees. Morris says, yes, the Palestinians were ethnically cleansed in 1948, but he says, I think it was a good thing. I think sometimes ethnic cleansings are good. He takes the case of North America, and he said, and now I'm using his words, if the native population of North America had not been annihilated, we couldn't have had the great American Republic. So he says it was a good thing to annihilate the population. Yeah. And he says in the case of Palestine, the ethnic cleansing was a good thing because it allowed for the creation of a Jewish state, which in his view is a higher good. You can't say his moral judgment is wrong in the same sense as you can call facts wrong. You may disagree with his moral judgment. You may want to say that it's a Nazi moral judgment, but you can't really say it's a wrong moral judgment in the sense of facts being wrong. If you leave Mr. Morris and people of his sort on the side, and you return to the moral universe of most normal human beings, you can agree on the facts, but disagree in your moral, legal, you can agree in the facts, agree in your moral judgments, agree in your legal judgments, but still disagree in your political judgments. Now that's a little bit more complicated, because most people think that their political judgments spring from their legal and moral judgments. But it's not necessarily so. So let's take the case of Professor Chomsky, who I suspect most of you in this room know by reading him or by reputation. So Professor Chomsky says what happened in 1948 was an ethnic cleansing, because that's what the scholarly record shows. And Professor Chomsky is always careful to quote the scholarly record. Morally, he says, the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians was an abomination, because for most normal human beings, ethnic cleansings are abominations. And legally, he says, Palestinians have the right of return, because that's a basic right under international law. I would want to mention here, because it's seldom known, that the right of return is uncontroversial under international law. And let nobody fool you about that. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, in 2000 and 2001, they issued official statements in the Palestinian right of return. And they stated, under international law, Palestinians who were expelled and subsequent generations which have retained genuine links to the land have the right to return. That is not a controversial question under international law. But, says Professor Chomsky, politically, I don't think it's going to happen. And I think that when you hold out the hope to Palestinian refugees in Lebanon that they're going to return, when you know they're not going to return, he says that's immoral. I'd say that's a legitimate point of view. What is political judgment? You take 1,000 different factors and you have to weigh what is and what is not feasible. If something is not feasible, then I think he's right. It is immoral to hold out hope. Other people can weigh those 1,000 factors and reach a different conclusion. They think it is feasible. Well, I think those are legitimate differences. Honest people can disagree on that, and neither side is the enemy. They just reach different conclusions, weighing the 1,000 different factors. It doesn't make any side to the conflict an enemy. Just as long as we agree on the first three, the historical question, we're not engaging in a revisionism that claims the Palestinians weren't expelled. Morally, we agree it's an abomination, and we don't make excuses for what happened in 1948. And legally, we recognize they have the right of return, and we're not making exceptions for Palestinians. They have the same right as everyone else. But we can disagree in the political judgment. Some people say, well, if you can't implement a right, then why speak of it as a right? That doesn't make any sense. And they criticize Professor Chomsky on those grounds. You on the one hand say they have a right of return, but then you're saying they're not going to return. So that seems hypocritical. And for the longest time, I had trouble trying to see the flaw with that argument. But then on a personal level, and don't confuse my personal travails with the genuine suffering of the Palestinian people and the Palestinian refugees, but on a personal level, it sort of became clear to me in recent times that the distinction does make sense. So as some of you know, I came up for tenure at my university this past year. I was denied tenure, and I felt I had a right to tenure, and I was confident that had I gone to court, that right would have been vindicated. But I decided, because lawyers told me, it's going to take about 6 years in court, it's going to consume 6 years of your life, it's going to be very expensive, that maybe you should accept a settlement short of that right, because it's not worth it struggling to see that right realized. It's just too much. And as some of you know, yeah, at the end I did take a settlement. Does that mean I didn't have the right to tenure? No. I'm absolutely certain I had the right. But practically, it just didn't seem feasible for me. Another 6 years, by the time I got it, I'd be ready to retire. So I accepted a settlement short of my right. But that doesn't mean I... Okay. That doesn't mean... I guess he was denied tenure too. Or I upset him with the memory. It's very painful for those who've gone through the process. But that doesn't mean I didn't have the right. And I think the same principle applies here. The fact that Palestinians may agree to a settlement short of the implementation of that right doesn't mean they don't have the right. It just means you have to choose which you're going to do. Continue the struggle? That's for them to decide. I'm not deciding it for them. I'm simply saying I agree with Professor Chomsky. There is a distinction to be made between the right, the moral and legal right, and the political right. That to me exhausts the range of legitimate controversy. But we should bear in mind that although the refugee question, I acknowledge, is complex, it's within a wider framework where there's no controversy. The borders, East Jerusalem, the settlements, those are resolved and uncontroversial questions. The preponderance of controversy surrounding the Israel-Palestine conflict, in my opinion, is completely made up. And I'll give you just a few examples. First of all, we're often told that this conflict is so complicated, so intricate, that it requires the knowledge equivalent of rocket science to penetrate its mysteries, that it's about a cosmic clash of civilizations, a cosmic clash of religions, it's about ancient enmities, and that this conflict is so complicated and so unique that you can't compare it to any other conflict. The reason for making that claim that you can't compare is pretty straightforward. Because when you start comparing it to other conflicts, Israel always comes out on the wrong side. So don't compare. The obvious historical analogy to what happened to the indigenous population of Palestine, the obvious historical analogy is what happened to the indigenous population of North America when the Euro-American settlers displaced the indigenous population. But when you make that comparison, obviously Israel doesn't come out as the indigenous population. So do not compare. It's unique. Or to take the current situation, the obvious comparison between what Israel is doing in the occupied territories is what the South African regime did during the apartheid years. But when you make the comparison with apartheid, people become hysterical in their denunciations. How can you compare? So when our ex-president, Mr. Jimmy Carter, writes a book, Palestine Peace, Not Apartheid, the hysteria unfolds, How dare he compare what Israel is doing with apartheid? The odd thing is, if you look at mainstream publications, mainstream figures, that comparison is always made. You take Israel's most distinguished and respected human rights organization, B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. It does a major study in 2002, and what does it conclude? Israel has created in the occupied territories a regime of separation based on discrimination, applying two separate systems of law in the same area, and basing the rights of individuals on their nationality. This regime is the only one of its kind in the world and is reminiscent of distasteful regimes from the past, such as the apartheid regime in South Africa. 2006, B'Tselem puts out a new report on the Jews-only roads that Israel is building in the occupied territories, and what did they conclude? This regime bears striking similarities to the racist apartheid regime, and in fact, it entails a greater degree of arbitrariness than was the case in South Africa under apartheid. Take Israel's most influential newspaper, Haaretz. 2006, September, writes an editorial, I'm not referring to the reporters now, the editorial board. It writes, the apartheid regime in the territories remains intact, millions of Palestinians are living without rights, and so on. October 2007, Israel's main newspaper, Haaretz, again, it refers to the de facto separation is today more similar to political apartheid than an occupation regime because of its constancy. Israel's former Attorney General, Michael Ben-Yair, compares Israel's policies to apartheid. Israel's former Education Minister, Shulamit Aloni, compares it to apartheid. You go down the list, everyone compares it to apartheid, even Ariel Sharon. When Ariel Sharon, the former prime minister, was asked by the Italian foreign minister how he proposed to resolve the conflict, he reportedly said, or it was reported in Haaretz, that, quote, the Bantustan model, the South African model, was the most appropriate solution to the conflict. In the real world, there's no controversy surrounding that claim. It's just when you enter the world of the media and public life, it becomes a controversy. Is the conflict so complicated? Does it require the equivalent of rocket science to penetrate its mysteries? Well, you read some of the American reporters, this fellow Jeffrey Goldberg, he says it's all about the Arab, the Muslim envy of the Jews. It's, you know, it's planted deep in their psyche. So he writes, trying to explain why these Muslims don't like Israel. It was terribly hard for Muslims to accept that their inferiors, the Jews, now ruled Palestine. This made no sense in the worldview of many Arab Muslims who were sure that they were better than the Jews. So that's the explanation. It's envy. The fancy term is ressentiment. Resentment of the Jews because they're so much better. Or you take the case of this other grand tête, this fellow named Paul Berman. He's a big intellectual in America. He writes this book, Terrorism and Liberalism, and he wants to explain why do Palestinians blow themselves up? And he's looking everywhere trying to figure it out. He looks through all the ancient texts, the contemporary texts, and finally he finds the answer. Voila, there it is in Albert Camus' The Rebel. He says, there it is, the explanation. First there was modernism, then there was the will to rebel, and then there was their will to die. Ergo, suicide bombers. That's the answer. Okay, now if we move away from that particular lunacy called the public media and life in the United States, and you go to reasonable historians. Benny Morris, as I've already suggested, is now so far on the right that he's fallen off the spectrum. You need a high-power telescope from the center to see him. But nonetheless, he remains a perfectly competent historian, and he can be perfectly lucid and sane in his conclusions. And at some point in his standard book, it's called Righteous Victims, he has to address the question, okay, why don't these Arabs like Zionism? And his answer is not too complicated. He says, the fear of territorial dispossession and displacement was to be the chief motor of Arab antagonism to Zionism. Transfer expulsion was inevitable and inbuilt into Zionism, and this aim automatically produced resistance among the Arabs. In other words, why are the Arabs not like Zionism? It's not so complicated. They feared their territorial displacement and dispossession. That is, they were afraid of losing their homes and losing their country. And then Morris says, in fact, that was perfectly rational, because expelling the indigenous population was inevitable and inbuilt into Zionism. There are no mysteries here. We don't need Nietzsche and Camus to explain the mysteries of the Muslim mind. All we need is a little common sense. And the odd thing about the Israel-Palestine conflict is these kinds of weird explanations and exotic explanations which are conjured up in the case of this conflict, where they applied in any other situation, people would laugh. So take the case of North America. The Native American resistance to Euro-American encroachment was very bloody. Let's not kid ourselves and let's not be so politically correct as to forget it. The Native Americans, they killed men, they killed women, they killed children. It's not for nothing that they were called savages, yesterday's terrorists. Not that the Euro-Americans didn't do the same, but we should be honest about it. It was very bloody. But what would anyone here think of a historian, a scholar, an intellectual, who, in order to explain that bloody resistance, were to say, well, the chief motor of Native American resistance to Euro-American encroachment, it was anti-Europeanism. Or anti-Christianism. Or anti-whiteism. Or the eccentricities of the Indian mind. Well, of course, you would laugh. Because it happens that the obvious explanation why the Native Americans resist, they fear territorial displacement and dispossession. It happens that the obvious explanation in the case of the native population of North America, as well as the case of the indigenous population of Palestine, it happens that the obvious explanation is also a sufficient one. You don't need exotic explanations about the inner workings of the Muslim mind. The second kind of fake controversy surrounding the Israel-Palestine conflict is the dragging in of the Holocaust card, the exploitation of the Nazi Holocaust, in order to immunize Israel from criticism of its human rights and diplomatic record. This has a long history. Time doesn't allow me to go through it. I'll just try for purposes here to summarize, in my opinion, the main or the crucial points. The main contribution of this thing that began in the 1970s, this Holocaust industry, was what came to be called the uniqueness doctrine, namely the claim that nobody in the history of humanity had ever suffered the way Jews suffered during the Nazi Holocaust. As an intellectual doctrine, it was completely empty. It is completely empty. As a moral doctrine, it's plainly an abomination. How can you possibly rank human suffering and say a child who is napalmed and whose skin is incinerated suffers less than a child who has been dispatched to a gas chamber? How can you prove it? Why would you want to prove it? And who would want to go there? This kind of ranking of human suffering is, in itself, it's pathological. If the doctrine has no intellectual value and it has no moral value, it does have a political utility. And it was that political utility that came to be used and continues to this day to be used in order to immunize Israel from criticism. So what happens if it's true, and factually it is true, that Israel is the only country in the world to legalize torture? Well, then we're told, but remember the Holocaust. And if it's true, and factually it is true, that Israel is the only country in the world to legalize house demolitions as a legal form of punishment, it occurred for a short period under Saddam Hussein, then we're told, but what about the Holocaust? And if it's true, and factually it is true, that Israel is the only country in the world to legalize hostage taking, or as the Chief Justice of the Israel High Court put it, the taking of bargaining chips, well, what about the Holocaust? And so the Nazi Holocaust is constantly used to trump basic principles of human rights and international law on the grounds that if Jews have suffered uniquely, then they shouldn't be held to the same moral and legal standards as everybody else, i.e., remember the Holocaust. And then in a kind of weird development, the Arabs, the Muslims, they came to be blamed for the Nazi Holocaust. Yes, we're told in the scholarly, in the so-called scholarly literature that they were responsible for the Holocaust or that they are lineal descendants of the Nazis. So the 1948 war, Israel's Prime Minister Ben-Gurion, their first prime minister, he says that, quote, the Arabs are the disciples and even the teachers of Hitler, who know only one way of solving the Jewish problem, total destruction. During the famous Eichmann trial in the early 1960s, the Palestinian leader, the Mufti of Jerusalem, he was a nasty piece of work. I don't particularly have any fondness for him. But all of a sudden, we were told during the Eichmann trial that he was, quote, among the biggest Nazi war criminals and the real mastermind of the final solution. Coming closer to the present, some of you who are older in the room will, of course, remember Gamal Abdel Nasser. And Nasser was called during the 1950s and 60s, not least by the British, incidentally, he was called the Hitler on the Nile. In June 67, he was called the new Hitler. And then coming up to the years which the younger people in this room will remember, 1991, we were told that Saddam was Hitler. In 2002, on the eve of the new illegal war against Iraq, we were told again Saddam was Hitler, and we were told anybody who opposed the illegal U.S. war against Iraq was an appeaser, like the appeasers of Hitler. In more recent years, we're told Hamas is Hitler, Hezbollah is Hitler, Iran is Hitler, Ahmadinejad is Hitler, everybody is Hitler. And it's a very odd thing, because on the one hand, we're told the Nazi Holocaust was unique. Do not compare. And if you compare it, you're guilty of Holocaust denial. But then, every other day, we're told every one of Israel's or the United States' enemies is Hitler. They're always comparing. The most recent version of this Holocaust industry is the so-called new anti-Semitism. This claim that the world is awash in an anti-Semitism, a Hitlerite anti-Semitism, that Europe is like Nazi Germany in 1938, the Jews are on the verge of being exterminated all over again. That's what the literature tells us. The facts are these. Number one, this new anti-Semitism is not new. And number two, it has nothing whatever to do with anti-Semitism. How do we know it's not new? Well, that's not difficult. Every few years, whenever Israel faces a public relations debacle, as it did when it started to inflict brutal suffering on the Palestinians after the Second Intifada, or whenever Israel comes under a international pressure to resolve the conflict diplomatically, they orchestrate this production called the new anti-Semitism. Go check your library. 1974. The ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, Israel's main public relations outfit in the United States, puts out a book the title, The New Anti-Semitism. 1982, the ADL puts out another book, the title, The Real Anti-Semitism, the thesis, There's a New Anti-Semitism in the World. And now in recent years, beginning around 2001, when Israel had all of these public relations problems due to its repression of the Second Intifada, they started again a new anti-Semitism. In fact, there's exactly zero evidence for a new anti-Semitism. There's no time to go through the record. What I'll just do is simply quote to you the leading Zionist historian in the world. Walter LeCur came out with a book a couple of years ago called The Changing Face of Anti-Semitism, Oxford University Press. We're told that Europe, it's on the verge of a new Holocaust. This Hitlerite anti-Semitism that's exploding in the mainstream of Europe. What does Walter LeCur write? I'll quote him exactly. Popular attitudes towards Jews in Europe are in fact slightly more favorable in 2002 than they had been in 1991. Not only is there no evidence of a new anti-Semitism, as any sane or rational person can tell you, there's less anti-Semitism in mainstream Europe than there has ever been before. If you start taking these claims of the Israel lobby and its supporters seriously, you reach really intriguing conclusions. So, for example, the Independent reports February 2007, quote, three-quarters of Israelis want to be in the European Union, and one-tenth would actually leave Israel for Europe if they were granted EU citizenship. But we're told Europe is awash with this Nazi-like anti-Semitism. So if we start piecing together our evidence, what do we conclude? Three-quarters of Israelis want Israel to ally with Nazis. And one in every 10 Israelis, one in 10 who want to move to Europe, one in every 10 wants to be exterminated. That's the conclusions you reach if you take seriously what these people are saying. What's the purpose of the new anti-Semitism? It's pretty straightforward. Nobody here will be surprised by the conclusions. Number one, it turns the perpetrator, Israel and its apologists, into a victim. So instead of focusing on the very real suffering of Palestinians, we're now told to focus on the alleged suffering of Jews. Number two, the purpose is obviously to discredit all of Israel's critics as being motivated by anti-Semitism. And we had a classic example of that with our former president, Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter comes out with a book, pretty tepid in its conclusions, uncontroversial in every respect. Jimmy Carter has a lot of influence in the U.S. He's the most revered president in the United States. They don't want to discuss the content of his book, so what did they do? The book comes out. Jimmy Carter is accused of being in the pay of Arab sheikhs. Then we're told Jimmy Carter is an anti-Semite. Then we're told Jimmy Carter is a borderline Holocaust denier. Then we're told Jimmy Carter is a Nazi sympathizer. And then we're told Jimmy Carter is a supporter of Arab terrorism. And that's exactly what you would expect. Because, as I've said this evening, they don't want to discuss that documentary record. Carter is very clear in that record. Chapter 16, he calls the wall as a prison. And he concludes, as I've mentioned earlier, that the problem with the reason we can't solve this problem is that Israel refuses to accept international law and withdraw to its legal borders. But we can't talk about that. So what do? We talk about whether Jimmy Carter is an anti-Semite, a Holocaust denier, a Nazi sympathizer, a supporter of terrorism. Divert attention from the scholarly record, divert attention from the documentary record, and talk about anything, just don't talk about the facts. And it worked like a charm in the United States. Go read the reviews of his book. There are these long, very erudite reviews about whether or not Jimmy Carter is an anti-Semite. Don't talk about those facts. Don't talk about how he describes Israel's ravaging of Bethlehem. No, let's not go there. And the last form, and I got the sign, and it's fine. I'm going to finish on time. The last kind of distortion that occurs of this conflict is the vast amount of sheer fraud and fakery that passes as scholarship on the Israel-Palestine conflict. Now, especially to this younger generation, which is addicted to the internet, it's no news to say that there's a large amount of fraud and fakery in public life. You know, about 70% of what you see on the internet ranges between crackpottery and lunacy. There's about 30% that has any intellectual content. In the case of your messages in Facebook, probably about 1% has intellectual content, I'm sorry to say. As far as your text messages, I would say probably 0% has any intellectual content. So it's no news to anyone in this room to say there's a lot of nonsense out there in public life. But what's peculiar about the Israel-Palestine conflict is the extent to which sheer nonsense, sheer fraud, sheer fakery, sheer chicanery is praised as serious scholarship and receives rave notices. So you take the case of this fellow at Harvard Law School, Alan Dershowitz. He writes a book called The Case for Israel. The book comes out from a very excellent publisher, not a crackpot publisher, a serious publisher, John Wiley and Sons. The book has excellent blurbs on the back of the book. The comments has a comment from Floyd Abrams, the leading First Amendment specialist in the United States, the general counsel for the New York Times. The book has excellent reviews, as a review from the New York Times Book Review. Excellent, the Boston Globe, excellent review. And we shouldn't in the least denigrate Professor Dershowitz's achievement. The fact is, unequivocal, he is the senior most professor at the most prestigious law school in the world, the Harvard Law School. He has a very distinguished academic pedigree. So you have distinguished publisher, distinguished blurbist, distinguished reviews, distinguished author, to the extent that he wrote the book. Yet, the book is a complete hoax. It's a fraud. That's not a pejorative. If I just hurled that epithet and said fraud and fake, of course you would have grounds to suspect me. But I did take the time to sit down and document across 300 pages that the book is a complete exercise in chicanery and fraud. And I'll admit there's a range of dispute about the magnitude of the fraud. Some people believe it begins with the first word on the first page and goes to the end. And then there's another school of thought that begins with the author's first name on the cover. As it happens, I belong to the second school, but I'll agree there's a range of debate. And the book is such a preposterous fraud that large parts of it are plagiarized from another fraud, the Joan Peters from Time Immemorial fraud that came out 20 years ago. It is kind of funny, you know. He not only plagiarizes, but he plagiarizes a hoax. That's, at the very least, it's innovative. And what's most striking about the book, and that's where I'm going to end off my prepared remarks, and hopefully we can talk. What's most striking about the book is his main thesis, his central thesis, is that Israel's human rights record is generally superb. That's what he claims. And as I told you earlier on, There is already now a voluminous human rights record, probably running all told into hundreds of thousands of pages. And not once, literally, this is not hyperbole, not once does he ever cite a human rights report to support his thesis that Israel's human rights record is generally superb. He never cites Amnesty, never cites Human Rights Watch, never cites B'Tselem. He does mention them to denigrate them, to disparage them, to heap abuse and insult on them. But he never cites them to support his thesis. Now, Professor Dershowitz is presumably, or and by acclaim, a very excellent lawyer. And as being an excellent lawyer, surely he knows that the validity of his thesis is enhanced when he can cite mainstream sources. So we can conclude he would want to cite Amnesty. He would want to cite Human Rights Watch. He would want to cite B'Tselem. He doesn't cite them not because he doesn't want to. He doesn't cite them because he can't. It's impossible to cite any mainstream human rights report and reach the conclusion that Israel's human rights record is generally superb. The only possible conclusion you can reach from reading these reports is that Israel's human rights record is generally abysmal. And it might seem that I'm ending on a down note, but quite the contrary, that particular finding leaves me very hopeful, because we have to bear in mind, I think, that however much money the other side has, and however ruthless the other side is, and however well organized and disciplined the other side is, we too have powerful weapons. And in my opinion, I'm pretty old-fashioned about these things, we have the most powerful weapons. We have truth on our side, and we have justice on our side. And truth and justice, not merely as abstractions, as some sort of cloud, we have them in concrete forms. We have the International Court of Justice on our side. We have the range of humanity in the United Nations General Assembly on our side. We have all the human rights organizations on our side. Those are very powerful weapons if we learn how to wield them, how to use them, how to mobilize around them. That's hard work. I suspect everyone in this room has heard of the Balfour Declaration. How many people have heard of it? Raise your hand. Of course. And everybody in this room will have heard of that partition resolution which divided Palestine, and according to Abba Abin, the foreign minister, it was Israel's birth certificate. How many people have heard of that partition resolution? Raise your hand. Good. But now here is the tragedy. How many of you knew that on every crucial issue, settlements, borders, Jerusalem, the world court decided in favor of the Palestinians? How many knew that? Look around you. You see, the Palestinians got their Balfour Declaration and partition resolution wrapped in one. They had everything. It was the most breathtaking defeat of the Israeli position by the highest judicial body in the world. Certainly as authoritative as that UN partition resolution, which was merely a General Assembly recommendation, but nobody knows it. And that's why we lose. Here we have to learn from the Zionists how you take paper victories, you mobilize around them, and turn them into political forces. That's what they did with the Balfour Declaration and the partition resolution. We have to learn how to wield our weapons, how to use our victories. how to make those victories politically effective. And I have a lot of faith. I've spent the last 5 or so days traveling around, doing too much, I think, traveling, and meeting the young people from FOSIS, very smart crowd, an efficient crowd, very competent crowd of people. I was kind of amazed at the level of efficiency and competency. And, you know, the challenge now is to you people in particular. You have the great benefits of getting a first-rate education and have the leisure of not having to struggle each day about food, electricity, fuel, just how to get from point A to point B without having to get stuck at a checkpoint and humiliated for 7 hours. And now it's your job. Do what the other side did. Don't be ruthless and don't be immoral. But learn how to wield those weapons, the weapons of truth and justice. And I'm absolutely confident. And I don't look at the world through rose-tinted glasses. That passed a long time ago. But I'm absolutely confident. If we learn how to wield those weapons of truth and justice, we show a little courage. We're not talking about a 5-year-old kid who throws a rock at a tank and gets his head blown off. That doesn't happen here. And we should be clear about that. All you have to do is show a little courage, have a little conscience, use that organization, discipline, and all the rest, put it to good use. And I'm perfectly confident that despite their power, their money, their ruthlessness, I'm sure, learn how to use those weapons of truth and justice, and we can win. Thank you.